Historically, thousands of murders are classified as unsolved across the UK. Modern forensic techniques help families find justice even after decades have passed. I'm Wensley Clarkson. I've worked inside the underworld for more than 30 years, alongside police officers, forensic scientists, and criminals. My research has included prison visits, surveillance operations, police visits, and even post-mortems. And now I want to take you on a journey into modern forensic science.
You're listening to the Real Silent Witnesses podcast from Graphic Audio. This podcast takes inspiration from my audiobook, The Real Silent Witnesses. So you'll also hear extracts from the book itself. This is The Real Silent Witnesses, Damilola Taylor.
I'm delighted to welcome to the show Tiernan Coyle, who's one of the UK's leading forensic fibre experts. Through the examinations of tiny fibres left on the crime scene, these scientists help link murder victims to their killers. This is how Tiernan and his colleagues brought those accused of Damilola Taylor's murder to justice 5 years after the crime. Damilola Taylor was only 10 when he was stabbed in the leg with a bottle in November 2000. The four teenagers accused of the murder walked free during the first trial in 2001. This shocked the nation and received widespread media coverage. But let's look at the case more closely with Tiernan Coyle. Welcome, Tiernan.
Hi, Wensley. Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure. Now, tell me a bit about yourself.
Well, my mum and dad were both secondary school science teachers. So the whole house was enveloped in science from as long as I can remember. So I think it was only natural that eventually I would head into some scientific career. But my interest in forensic science only came through later in life.
Right. And so you're into science. You've got two parents, who are science teachers. So it's pretty obvious where that all came from. How did you then evolve? I mean, obviously, you went to university. What sort of degree did you get there? And how relevant was it to what you later became?
Well, I was fascinated by chemistry and physics. That was my main kind of area of science. So I did a degree in a place called Dublin City University in the early to mid-90s. And the degree was called Analytical Science, which is kind of a convoluted way of describing the applied sciences, really, how to identify materials and quantify them, which obviously gives you a good grounding if you are to pursue a career in something like forensic science. And I was struggling to find a job in forensic science after I left university. My wife worked in a pharmaceutical company in Wicklow in Ireland, and they had just opened a huge manufacturing plant in Singapore and needed people to go over there to start up the laboratory for the pharmaceutical company. And back in the old fledgling days on the internet with dial-up and everything, I went on the internet and the Singaporean lab were hiring. And I whipped off CB and had a phone interview. And half an hour later, I was essentially off to Singapore.
So where did you go from there? Did you come back to Britain or what was your next move?
After 2 years, we came back to the United Kingdom. On the way, I stopped off to do an interview with a brand new company. As far as I knew, I didn't know that much about them, called Forensic Alliance, whose chief executive was Angela Gallup. And we did an interview there. And then a few days later, they told me I'd been successful. So about January of 2000, I started off in Forensic Alliance. And we were such a small company at that point. There was only, I think, 25 of us.
Well, two decades have passed since the Forensic Alliance was founded, and its name was subsequently changed to LGC. In recent years, I researched the lab very carefully, and in the audiobook, I describe what I found. Take a listen.
The labs within the LGC's main building in Oxfordshire run off a vast, long corridor, and the overriding theme is blue. It's mostly spotlessly clean, and there is no sign of wear and tear. Every set of swing doors contains security keypads. On the doors are bright red and yellow notices. No entry for unauthorized personnel. Danger, hazardous materials. Approved clothing must be worn. The most dramatic notice of all is, stop, DNA-sensitive area. Do not enter unless you have given an elimination sample. Beyond the swing doors are technicians in hairnets, face masks, scrubs, lab coats, and two pairs of latex gloves. One long, blue and pulled up over coat cuffs, the second short, flesh-coloured and changed with great frequency. All exhibits from crime scenes arrive and are immediately and carefully logged. Depending on the type of case and the nature of the evidence, an appropriate senior scientist is allocated to oversee each job. All this evidence has already been meticulously documented at a crime scene, where it is known as the chain of custody process. The minuscule clues found during close inspection of every inch of a crime scene include hairs, fibers, and latent fingerprints, which are often not visible to the naked eye. All evidence is then tested and stored in the presence of a video camera, which is done to avoid any of it being dismissed as inadmissible evidence in a court of law. Tucked well away from natural light, other forensic examiners toil away in the Marks and Traces laboratory, located within the main laboratory building. At first sight, it looks like a well-equipped school lab with 10 rows of benches. Each bench contains a computer screen, microscope, and sheets of brown wrapping paper covering lumpen shapes. These shapes are bagged evidence taken from crime scenes throughout the UK. The paper is used to help stop contamination. At the far end of the room, a forensic scientist hunches over a trainer being held steadily under a fluorescent strip light fixed from the ceiling. Investigator dusts the shoe with aluminium powder before holding it against an acetate sheet in order to take an imprint of the sole. This will be matched against imprints taken from the scene of the crime. Next to that investigator, a car wheel and tire rest upright and untended. On another bench close by, an acetate sheet bears the imprint of a shoe sole from another unsolved crime. Inside LGC's DNA unit, scientists can search for DNA in everything from blood to brick dust.
And Tiernan, you were amongst all these experts at LGC, carefully examining every inch of fibre that might have been unnoticed. Can you talk us through a typical day at LGC, for example? If you walked in and you didn't have a case ongoing, would cases appear? I imagine not every single day, but how did the process, what was it like in there, inside that lab? And is it as busy as we see in the drama versions of LGC, which obviously are in the Silent Witness series, as well as other series about forensic science? How does that all compare, and what was it like in there?
I suppose an average day in any forensic science laboratory is remarkably dull. it's not so dramatic that you might see on the telly or in the movies, but you do have moments of high drama when, you know, something high profile might come your way.
Can you tell me one of these moments of high drama that stick in your mind?
I think the first meetings in cases like Damilola Taylor, when those cases end up on your door, they end up on your door because there's been a problem with them. And so they already come with significant kind of baggage. So you know when you approach those meetings, those kind of first discussions with police officers, there's an awful lot of pressure on them and the expectations on you are going to be very high.
You've mentioned Damilola Taylor. Before we go on to discuss how your analysis of textile fibres helped solve the case, let us recall what actually happened that day.
At 4:51 p.m. on the 27th of November 2000, 10-year-old schoolboy Damilola Taylor set off from Peckham Library in South London to walk home. He was filmed on CCTV, happily skipping along the pavement as he approached the North Peckham estate where he lived. Moments later, three boys, aged 12, 13, and 14, tried to steal Demilola's silver puffer jacket, the only item of value he had on him. During a scuffle, a broken bottle punctured the left part of Damilola's thigh, which severed an artery. Staggering to a stairwell, the schoolboy collapsed, bleeding profusely, as emergency services rushed to the scene. Damilola was still alive when an ambulance picked him up some minutes later. He died minutes after he arrived at hospital. It was 10 days before his 11th birthday. The killing of an innocent 10-year-old boy in South London shocked the nation and has never been forgotten. As one journalist wrote in 2006, that CCTV footage showed a happy, smiling schoolboy hopping and skipping with the insuppressible exuberance of childhood across the flagstones of a shopping precinct. It was Peckham, but it could have been anywhere in Britain. Crucial evidence identifying the alleged killers of Damilola was missed by forensic scientists in the days following the killing. In 2002, the three suspects were all acquitted of the involvement in the death of the 10-year-old schoolboy. Fast forward 4 years to 2006, and a brand new team of forensic scientists was tasked with uncovering fresh evidence that, it was hoped, would lead to a retrial of the accused boys. Forensic scientists faced an uphill task from the moment they got involved. As a result, this new forensic team made the time-consuming decision to re-examine every piece of relevant evidence they had access to. Many months later, scientists found a blood stain on the heel of one suspect's trainer. They also discovered a much smaller stain on the cuff of his brother's sweatshirt. Both samples of blood belonged to Damilola Taylor. As one member of the new forensic team later explained, the police got a lot of flack when the suspects were originally acquitted, but in fact the forensic scientists who first worked on the case had missed a bloodstain on the back of a pair of trainers that matched Damilola's DNA. The new team of forensic scientists uncovered a textile fiber embedded in an item belonging to one of the suspects that matched fibers from Damilola's jumper. This meant it must have been transferred when the blood was wet. A fiber from the trousers Damilola was wearing at the time of the attack was found within that blood spot. Another speck of Damilola's blood was recovered from the cuff of a sweatshirt belonging to one of the suspects. One of the scientists who discovered this new evidence later told a court that human error by the original forensic investigators most likely occurred because gathering evidence is such a painstaking process that it was relatively easy to mislay such evidence. The new team of forensic scientists presented to the court alternative events that could have led to Damilola Taylor's fatal wounds. The theory, eventually accepted by the court, was that he was attacked and fell on a broken bottle, later bleeding to death. The time-consuming work of the new forensic team eventually helped convict two teenage brothers for the manslaughter of Damilola nearly 6 years after their original acquittal. They were each given 8 years in youth custody.
So you were part of this new team of experts that re-examined all the evidence. Let's look at this a little more closely. You often come in as a fibre expert after all the traditional forensic elements have been tried, tested, and either not worked or are slightly questionable in terms of results. So you come in. How would that have worked out with Damilola Taylor? You're in there, and the police come in. You know, having had these suspects that then were released, etc. Just fill us in on how it all came to land in your lap.
I remember one of my former university lecturers talking about fibres, and he used to say, you know, it's like that moment in Star Trek when they say, oh, I take it the odds are against us that the situation is grim. And that's when you tend to see the fibre expert coming through the door. And I remember talking to a police officer who I'd worked with over a few times in a few kind of serious investigations. And he says, you know, Tiernan, I really love what you do and what you can bring to the investigation. But, you know, if I see you walking through the door, it means we're in big trouble with these cases. But with Damilola, the source of this case came from the senior investigating officer primarily. He was the one who took the decision. It was a guy called Nick Efgrave. And he was the one who took the decision, a really brave decision, to take everything out from the previous forensic laboratory, which was the Forensic Science Service, and ship it to us. And his strategy was really to start again, to wind the clock back to when this case first happened and see, rather than trying to work your way through what had been done before and what had gone wrong, really start over.
Was that hard for you professionally because you were being asked to analyze, reanalyze something that was supposed to have been closed off by another lab that's now been told we're starting all over again and we're not using you, in effect?
Yeah, I mean, I felt a lot of sympathy for the Forensic Science Service scientists who, you know, had put so much hard work and time and effort into this case only to see it kind of crumble around them. I can't imagine what that must have been like for them. And I had expected, you know, because we know each other well, this forensic science community. It's a very small one. I had expected there to have been a lot of fibre work done and for there, you know, perhaps not so much by way of opportunity left for me to explore. I knew the quality of the forensic science work done by the Forensic Science Service tended to be very good. So I wasn't altogether hopeful until we had that first case conference. And when we had that first case conference, the Forensic Science Service scientist said, you know, and, you know, as for the fibres, don't even go there. That was his phrase that he used. And I found out then that they actually hadn't done very much fibre work at all.
Why did they not do enough fibre work?
There were a number of reasons. First of all, at this point, there had been a first trial for individuals within this kind of gang of individuals in Peckham. I think there were 14 suspects altogether. Probably around 300 or 400 items of clothing had been sent into the Forensic Science Service, all to be done urgently, so it kind of overwhelmed them. But Damilola was wearing a silver puffer jacket when he died, which was zipped up, and it didn't shed its fibres, which means it wouldn't have expected to have any fibres or much fibres transfer from the silver puffer jacket onto a suspect. So on that basis, they didn't look for Damilola's fibres on any of the suspect's clothing.
And why would they make that assumption? I understand the material wouldn't have transferred much, but even so, if you're looking at it minutely, you should be able to work out what it is.
I can't speak for the forensic scientists who made this kind of choice, but it probably was against the background of what they had to do with processing 400 items of clothing.
And that's where you come in. I'd like you to talk me through the whole process, step by step, in a minute. But first, let's hear about how fibres can help experts when re-examining evidence.
Experts have developed tests that can detect increasingly minute particles linking murder victims to their killers. Every time someone puts on a coat, hugs somebody, or sits on a sofa, tiny little fibres from their clothing will be left behind. Individuals can also pick up similar fibres left on those same objects by other people. This is known as fibre transfer, and forensic scientists now test for it all the time to solve crimes. As a result, textile fibres have become one of the most important types of evidence available to a forensic examiner. The key to this type of forensic work is not the fibre itself, but how it came to get where it was found in the first place. Until recently, it had been presumed that fibre transfer only occurred when two surfaces touched, like when a jumper touches the shirt of someone else. That is now known not to be the case. Fibres can be transferred in other ways too. Forensics call this contactless airborne transfer. It's when fibres move from one garment to another without contact. This means two people can be in the same room, not even touching each other, and the fibers of one person's clothing can transfer through the air to the other person present. A typical example would be two people who were in an elevator when one allegedly assaulted the other. If hundreds of the victim's fibers are found on the suspect's clothing, it's highly unlikely that contactless transfer alone is the reason for all those fibers. If only a few fibers are found, contactless transfer is most likely to be the case.
So the analysis of fibers that transfer between the victim and his killer is what helped your team crack this case. The way that you were able to re-examine all of that material and then ascertain things that were not ascertained before single-handedly brought about the prosecution, really. So tell me about the first day and how it comes into you. You start the process. It's a long, laborious process. There's a lot of items of clothing, etc., involved. How long did it take you to do all that first stage to when you actually got to a point where you'd found some evidence of cross-contamination of fibres?
So the first thing I did was to look at Dan Lola's clothing. And what I noticed was that the surface of Dan Lola's puffer jacket were covered in fibres from the jumper he was wearing underneath. There was also information from witness statements suggesting that whoever had attacked Damalola, the motivation to do so was to steal his silver puffer jacket. So, you know, if you're attacking somebody to try and steal their jacket, what you're going to do is try and get it off them. So that could have exposed the school uniform jumper. The surface of it could have been exposed underneath. And if it's been exposed, well, then the attacker may have had contact with it, and we should potentially be looking for fibres from his jumper on the clothing. And also, he was stabbed through the leg, through his trousers that he was wearing, and the trousers did shed fibres. So if there's obviously been contact between the offender and his trousers, so we would expect those to transfer as well. And from that point, it was merely a process of looking through all of the suspect's clothing for these fibres, which was laborious to start with. And we had 14 suspects to go through. But actually, I think we were quite fortunate in the sense that we happened to start, or, you know, the Preddy brothers were part of the 14 suspects at this point. And we didn't, I don't, can't remember whether we started with them, but they were certainly much higher up the list of exhibits to work through. And so we got our first breakthrough when we found some fibres from the school uniform jumper on their clothing.
How long did that take to even to get to just that point?
It probably took about 2 months from the time we started the examinations.
Does that mean that every single day of those two months, or 5 days every week, you were minutely examining these items of clothing over and over again?
How we recover fibres from the clothing is we take kind of pieces of tape and press them onto the surface of the clothing and recover the fibres from there. And it's the tapings that we're searching painstakingly under the microscope for these fibres. And if you can imagine looking at the surface of Wembley Stadium, grassy surface of Wembley Stadium, and just looking for particular shades of green that stand out from the grass itself, that's the kind of painstaking process it has to go through.
So you've got 2 months in and you've had a breakthrough. Tell me what happens after that.
Well, I was working closely with other scientists, obviously, my expertise in fibres, but there was blood and DNA and body fluid examinations going on at the same time. We were working closely together with those scientists. And a lady called Roz Hammond did the biological evidence. And around the time I found one of the fibres on one of the clothing, she was examining a trainer from one of the Preddy brothers. And it had a small spot of blood that turned out to be Damalola's in the end, but in the blood was a fibre, but it was absolutely tiny. It was less than half a millimetre long, in from what I remember.
Wow. So hold on. So in that speck of blood was a minute fibre.
That's right. A tiny, tiny fibre, and it turned out to be a polyester fibre from Damalola's trousers.
That's an incredible find. I mean, when you find that. That's a combination of her expertise and yours in a sense, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she was poring over that trainer looking for blood stains under the microscope.
How long would she have been looking for that?
From what I remember, I think that this stain was relatively easy to spot with the naked eye. A trainer is very difficult surface to look at because it's curved and you have to kind of zoom in and out under the microscope. So it could be hours, it could be days looking at a surface.
So I'm trying to build up to this eureka moment, if you want to call it that. So you establish that, wow, not only is this speck of blood being found, but inside that speck of blood is a minute fibre, which is crucial. At what moment did you discover that? So you've been given this blood sample, or the speck, and then you examine that for how long did you examine that before you found that fibre?
That was quite straightforward thing to do because we were able to recover the half a millimeter long fibre. And what we were kind of excited about in relation to this was Damlola had been stabbed with a broken beer bottle. And on the edge of the broken beer bottle was Damlola's blood. But in along the kind of cut, sharp edge of that were fibres from Damlola's trousers. So if there's a blood droplet which is wet and has landed on a trainer and it contains a fibre from Damlola's trousers in it, the possibilities rose. Well, then that blood droplet arose from the bottle, the sharp edge of the bottle. And then what the prosecutors would have been interested in then was be presenting to the jury the for them to consider that the person wearing this trainer was either holding the broken bottle or was very close to someone who was holding it.
Well, so it was absolutely crucial, this. And when you establish that, you do what? I mean, it might be a bit of an anticlimax. Maybe you just give someone a phone call, but do you have a meeting to discuss it?
We would have regular updates, either on the phone or person to person in meetings with the police. But before that happens, as a scientist, you don't want to rush in and tell the police that you've found something unless you're absolutely sure that you can support what you want to say with, you know, scientific reasoning. So when I looked at that fibre, I wanted to make sure, first of all, that it was indistinguishable to the trousers, which it was. We knew it was in the blood stain, which it was. We had to wait for the DNA result to come back from the blood to confirm whether or not it's Damlola's, which it did. But at that point, what I was looking at was the end of this half a millimetre long fibre because it had a very distinctive microscopic appearance. If you can imagine, a fibre is usually quite smooth. A synthetic one like that is usually quite smooth. But this had been very badly damaged. It was almost like a yard brush at the end. It had these kind of strings coming out of the end. It looks like a brush. And I found fibres bearing similar characteristics to those on the edge of the bottle.
So what other fibre evidence did you establish which helped connect these boys to the killing?
So when the Preddy brothers were arrested, one was staying at a children's home not far from where they lived, and the other one was staying at home. But during the search for the items of clothing, for Ricky Preddy, they were in the bottom of the clothing. For Danny Preddy, they were in his room in the children's home. But what the police had done was kind of bagged them all up together and then put them in separately. So we had some information from CCTV of the day before Damlola died as to what one of the brothers was wearing. And it was kind of like a Nike athletic hooded top, which was in amongst these items of clothing. And we found four fibres from Damlola's jumper on that item of clothing, and then kind of small numbers of fibres on the other clothing that it had been bundled up with.
So if you came back to the original lab that failed to find these, that was really about the fact they had 400 items of clothing and therefore they probably didn't examine them that minutely. Is that a fair enough assumption?
They didn't examine them at all for Damlola's school jumper or his trousers. So it was a failure. And many of these cases that we've come back to over the years, the failure happens very early on in the investigation. And the failure in this case, in relation to the fibres, was they just didn't conduct a proper, full and proper fibre examination. And I'm sure they will say it's because they were overwhelmed.
Has this led to a change in the way that this level of examination is carried out following a murder? Has it made it a more intense process because of your findings? Because you did prove that the previous lab had not really concentrated enough, to be simplistic about it.
You would think it should, and you would think it would. But what happened in this case was that blood was missed as well. So although that had been examined for blood by the original laboratory, somehow they had missed that spot of blood containing the fibre in it. And there was a big inquiry into why that happened, how the Forensic Science Service missed the blood on there. But they chose to completely kind of stay away from all the fibre evidence, which was, I don't know why that happened. I think that was an opportunity missed to explore the reasons why that happened.
Besides fibre, what other pieces of evidence proved that these boys did do it, ultimately?
There was blood on the training shoe of Danny Preddy, and there was blood on one of the sweatshirts worn by Ricky Preddy. And together with the fibres, that formed the main part of the forensic evidence against them. In the very first trial, which led to the acquittal of four other suspects, one of the suspects did have a piece of broken glass on his training shoe, which matched kind of broken beer bottles and broken glass around the scene, but it wasn't considered kind of strong enough evidence to proceed with.
They couldn't actually pin it on that bottle, is that what you're saying?
I believe so, and they couldn't. I think the suspect who had the piece of glass had been in that area or had visited prior to his trainers being seized. So there were other explanations for how that could have got there.
Did working on this case help you to fine-tune your investigative skills, so to speak?
One thing this taught me is you should never make assumptions based on what the eyewitnesses say or what the police believe to be the case. It's something that has always stayed with me. Why are we making these assumptions not to proceed with fibre examinations? Is it scientific? Is it reasonable?
Do you think some of the time it's just been down to economics?
Certainly from the police side, having to pay for fibre examinations, which are long and extensive, it is an economic decision. But you have to remember, the irony is when forensic science fails, it fails huge. So all the kind of savings that you might kind of accrue over a long period of time can be wiped out by one big failed investigation. This case of Damilola Taylor ended up costing the taxpayer something in the range of 30 or 40 million pounds.
So they would have saved themselves a lot of money if they got it right the first time round.
Absolutely, yeah. All for the sake of a fibre examination, which may have cost maybe £5,000 to £10,000.
Yeah, now you mentioned the police there. And obviously, as we said at the beginning of the programme, these privatised labs have come to the forefront in the last 25 years, I guess. Before we move on, let's hear about how the forensic services shifted from being publicly funded to being privatised.
The UK's Forensic Science Service began life as a network of regional forensic science labs back in the 1930s. In 1996, the Metropolitan Police Laboratory in Lambeth, South London, was taken over by the FSS, which at that time assumed complete control of forensic services throughout the UK. The FSS became England and Wales's largest employer of forensic scientists. The service came under the aegis of the UK Home Office. In Scotland, the responsibility fell to specific police forces. In Northern Ireland, the regional government ran it. But the vast majority of FSS employees were paid out of the coffers of their respective police forces. By 2000, the FSS was processing around 90,000 cases a year and regularly dealt with incidents of murder, sexual assaults, burglary, drugs and firearms. However, in 2003, just 7 years after the FSS took over the UK's forensic system, the Labour government under Tony Blair announced it was paring back the organisation in a cost-cutting exercise. Ministers encouraged UK police forces to begin contracting out their forensic work to private companies, which were rapidly launching into the marketplace. The UK government believed at the time that this move would help create a highly competitive marketplace and that forensic costs would be driven down to provide better value for money. But many British forensic scientists were appalled by the move because they considered their scientific work too important to be simply sent out to tender. In 2011, three FSS laboratories were closed in an attempt to balance the books following a £50 million government bailout 2 years earlier. At this time, the FSS still accounted for 65% of the UK's forensics market, with the remaining 35% taken up by companies in the private sector. In 2012, the new Conservative government announced the FSS would be completely closed down. Home Office Minister James Brokenshire claimed that the service was losing £2 million a month. He stated it was uncompetitive by charging too much for its services, and consequently losing business to commercial rivals. One London forensic scientist commented, "It was akin to telling criminals they had a free rein to do what the hell they wanted because the police no longer had some of the tools they needed to solve crimes." As a result of the FSS closure, some of the UK's foremost forensic scientists moved abroad, where salaries were higher and jobs were considered more secure than they were in London and other British cities. Those cutbacks and the closure of the FSS sparked a mini brain drain, explained one London forensic scientist. "It felt like we were being pushed out of the way in a cost-cutting exercise, which completely ignored the need for our services when it comes to solving crimes." Meanwhile, the UK police continued their drive to cut budgets and costs. This resulted in them becoming over-focused on DNA evidence to the exclusion of key corroborative branches of forensic science, ranging from weapons examination to fingerprinting. One forensic scientist told me recently, "It was an appalling situation. We were scientists trying to solve deaths, and we found ourselves in the middle of bidding wars where private forensic companies were undercutting each other to get work. The police were even asking forensic labs for quotes and dropping entire investigations because they couldn't afford the fees being quoted. In other words, crime investigations were being shelved purely for financial reasons. Not good."
So, Tiernan, do you think that the privatisation of forensics labs made the relationship with the police sometimes quite awkward in a way it might not have been when the labs were public?
I think that there are certainly pros and cons to both. Because I've worked in a state laboratory and a private sector laboratory, I even had my own laboratory, this always tends to fall into a public sector versus private sector to debate. I mean, the great thing about having a public sector laboratory is that you can decide what you want to do and how you want to do it without feeling the pressure of a police force saying, well, we're not paying for this or we're not paying for that. And from purely a scientific point of view, that would seem to be a better quality approach. But where it falls down is that you tend to get there in our police forces submitting hundreds and hundreds of items of clothing and you get backlogs of cases.
Because they're sort of covering the backsides in a way, aren't they? How does this relate to the Damilola Taylor case?
Yeah, and it's very difficult to triage cases in the sense of being able to determine what it is being done. The irony with Damilola Taylor is that we work within a private sector kind of market at that point. Forensic Science Service were charging the police, just like all the private sector laboratories were. They still managed to get swamped with 400 items of clothing, all to be done, you know, tomorrow.
How do you find your relationship with the police on the whole? I mean, if I went back 50 years, the forensic scientists were considered irritants to a lot of policemen. But these days, obviously, things are different. But how do you find it?
I think the role of the police in forensic science has changed considerably over the last 10 to 15 years. And certainly since the Forensic Science Service closed, I can't say it's changed for the better.
Right. Can you tell me a little bit more why you're saying that?
Well, what happened really when the Forensic Science Service closed? The Forensic Science Service used to have the ear of the government. It used to be able to determine or certainly have a voice or say in forensic science policy or strategy at a government level, at a Home Office level. And one of the major things that happened was the global financial crisis in 2008.
and the huge cuts that came down on the public sector around that time. And it was just kind of unfortunate that at that point, when the global financial crisis happened, there were huge reforms going on within the forensic science marketplace.
Right.
They were just about to open up the entire market to the private sector, whereas before, in order to work for police forces, you had to enter into an arrangement with a police force, and there's 43 of them in England and Wales, which meant that the Forensic Science Service was able to kind of dominate forces that have built up relationships with for many years. I don't know if you remember, but back in 2005, the Tony Blair government tried to merge police forces from 43 down to 8 in England and Wales, and the reform ultimately failed.
Right.
But one lesson that came out of that reform was that police forces should come together as a big purchasing body to buy forensic services and then put them out to tender to private companies of which the Forensic Science Service would compete with. But the Forensic Science Service being the dominant share, I think it was over 80% at that point, they had everything to lose, you know. In order for the private sector to prosper, they had to lose their market share. And being a state-run company at that point, they had a huge burden of pensions and all kinds of financial issues that made them very difficult and unwieldy in comparison to their competitors. So when they started to lose market share, it put them in a very difficult financial position, and ultimately the government decided to close them down.
So let me ask you this, going back to you and your job, which is so crucial. You touched on this at the beginning, but it seems to me that in a way you're like the fireman of the forensic industry. You sort of come in often late, and that means that you're not on a hiding to nothing in a sense, because others have already possibly failed ahead of you. This happened in the Damilola Taylor case too, where you had to deal with items that had been handled by a lot of other scientists, but you've got to deal with items that have often been handled a lot because you're not getting them straight off the crime scene, et cetera, et cetera. That must be frustrating for you, but just tell me what is a typical problem that you face in handling evidence that's been kicking around for a while.
I mean, the approach of coming in later on into investigations, it's not the ideal approach. In my view, these things should be done in tandem. It's kind of all belt and no braces when you're just looking for body fluids and DNA. And if you don't find it, then, you know, you've got nothing left to go to.
So what did you use to find evidence in the Damilola Taylor case? What are the tools of your trade? Sellotape is one I know, but what's in your toolbox?
The most important thing of any forensic investigation is finding the evidence in the first place. So it might seem really kind of basic, but you're right. It's sticky tape to recover the fibers and then a microscope to look for them. And once you found them, that's when you put in all the high-tech technological processes to determine whether or not they match a particular garment or not. But actually, the fundamental part and the hardest work comes from searching for the fibres in the first place. And like with Damilola case, you know, you've got to make the choice to look for them in the first place. And you've got to have the knowledge and expertise and confidence to do so.
Do you ever get called in to crime scenes directly before the evidence has been collected and taken away?
No, not really. That's entirely done by the crime scene investigators. The recovery at the crime scene is done by them.
Do you ever request going back to a crime scene because of something you found subsequently?
Yes, I have done. Where you find fibres on the surface of a body, for example, that are interesting to you, maybe they're on the mouth of a victim who's been strangled or around the neck. You might not have a suspect at that time, but you know that these fibres are significant. They could have come from the offender, but you want to be sure. What you'd make sure to happen is that the CSIs go back to the scene, sample soft furnishing perhaps in other areas within the scene, just kind of to eliminate them as the source of the fibres.
And how do you see the fibre transfer evolving as a very, very important part of the forensic process?
I think what's held fibres back is not as kind of... It is universally applicable to all crime scenes. Because whoever you are, you have to either leave fibres at the scene or on the victim or take them away with you. Because you have to have physical contact with the victim in order to commit the crime. So the fibres will always be transferring somehow. It's only our lack of imagination and lack of desire or enthusiasm for the evidence type which prevents us from looking at it. But our system within forensic science in England and Wales certainly works against the evidence type being used. And that's primarily down to costs. And the cost comes from having the need for highly skilled people to spend hours and hours searching tapings for fibres. So an automated process to do that would really allow fibres to flourish within the forensic science market, make it the essential part of toolbox that it used to be.
Cold cases are something that really are your forte in a sense, because all the cases you get involved in have been gone through the system to a certain degree already.
The fibres have to be recovered first, and it's very rare that a fibre scientist would be the first one to get into an item of clothing in a brown paper bag that had been secured by police. Because primarily that searches for blood and body fluids, they're the searches that go on. They're the searches that go on there first. So it's the duty of the person searching for blood and body fluids to recover the fibres as well. Thankfully, 20, 30, 40 years ago, the primary focus as soon as scientists got an item out of the bag was to recover everything, store everything, because you never know what you're going to need in the future. So there are always fibre tapings in the Forensic Science Service archive that you can go back to from 30 years ago. And many of these tapings have been solely responsible for the successful solving of cold cases via DNA many years later, not just fibre evidence. It's been the tapings that have been the source of these materials.
What I find strange is that it seems that often you're coming in as a last resort, like in the Damilola Taylor case, and I find that surprising.
What's happened since 2008, since the global financial crisis and the demise of the FSS, is the police have taken complete control over what forensic scientists do. So if the police are not doing it themselves, they will say, search this item for blood and blood alone. And they would even go to the extent of saying, you know, don't even recover fibres.
Doesn't this beg the question, there should be someone who wears both hats? Is there a place for an officer who actually is a forensic policeman? And therefore he can be that halfway, he's the person in the middle of it who can say, hang on a minute, we should do this, we shouldn't do that. Unlike the policemen who are in a rush to solve a case, and unlike yourselves who are in the dark, basically, until they tell you.
Yeah, it's largely driven by procurement people who don't want to spend money on parts of recovery, which they don't think is as valuable as others. But the point is, you don't know what's valuable.
Do you ever get families coming directly to you to ask you to try and help them to disprove or prove something about one of their relatives?
It does happen, but normally it's on the defence side. It's through a solicitor, or if it's on the prisoner side, somebody trying to appeal their conviction, it comes from a body like the Criminal Case Review Commission. So the amount of times we were contacted directly by the public is very few and far between.
Obviously, Damilola Taylor had a lot of nationwide publicity. I know a number of the other cases you've been involved with have. Does that put extra pressure on you?
Well, it shouldn't really, because the quality of the work you do is the same. But we're all human beings and we're all fully aware of the pressure that everybody is under. And it does affect you. I remember in the Damilola Taylor case being outside the courtroom waiting to give evidence. I'd been waiting outside the court for 5 days straight, and there were lots of things going on in the court that I wasn't aware of, which delayed them getting to me as a witness. But I was almost ready to pack it in. I was absolutely exhausted mentally and physically. And back then, when that trial eventually came to a conclusion, it was during the time when Abu Hamza was on trial in the Old Bailey, and the murder of Billy Joel Jenkins was also being prosecuted at that time. So there was a huge media circus around the Old Bailey with three high-profile cases going on. And it was all kind of adding to my distress at the time. But I remember Richard Taylor coming out of the courtroom, Damilola's dad, and he'll never know. I never met him and never got a chance to talk to him. But he came out and he was very distressed about something that had gone on in the courtroom. And he was talking to the family liaison officer, who was about 20 to 30 feet away from me. And I was just kind of looking around, I think, and I thought to myself, you've got to get a grip of yourself here, Tiernan, because this poor man is only trying to seek justice for his murdered son. He's been through all of this to get to this point, and it's all unnecessary. And he just gave me that little bit of inspiration that I needed to want to get control of my emotions and go in and finish the job.
Yeah, I see exactly what you mean. And it's like a reality check in a sense. Are there other cases where you haven't found evidence that some policemen or defendants hoped you would find? And do you ever find yourself under pressure because of that?
You know, managing expectations is a huge part of the job. People have kind of accused private laboratories of all kinds of things related to money and their motivations. And some people have accused private labs of being paid to find things, but actually, what we're paid to do is to search for them, whether we find them or not. depends if they're there. And in relation to the defence and their clients, our role as defence scientists is to clarify the strength of evidence against the defence team's client. So our interactions with them on the family and so on are very minimal. But their expectations of you could be in the region of whether you'd be able to get their client off or whatever, but actually that's not the reality of it at all.
Of course. Okay, brilliant. You've been fantastic, Tony. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for listening to The Real Silent Witnesses with Tiernan Coyle. Personally, I was amazed to discover that the most minute fragments of material could actually bring a killer to justice. And yet often this technique is only used as a last resort. It's a fascinating subject, but you should always be free to draw your own conclusions and interpret and deduce the facts in any way you feel comfortable with. Make sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, so you'll never miss a show. And while you're at it, if you like the show, we'd appreciate a rating on Apple Podcasts and tell a friend about it. For a more in-depth analysis into forensics, check out my audiobook, The Real Silent Witnesses, which is available at all good stores, including Audible and Apple Books, published by W.F. Howes. Be sure to tune in next week for our latest episode. And remember, the dead tell us everything.